nanotechnology and things way beyond that. And what I'm going to do is first introduce all of our speakers in the order they'll be speaking in, then very briefly kind of introduce the topic of the panel. Each of the panelists will talk for about 15 minutes, and then we'll have plenty of time for questions. First speaker to my right, and that reminder of turning off things that ring would be really nice. First speaker to my right is Amy Cannon, and Amy is the executive director of an organization called Beyond Benign, which is a nonprofit dedicated to green chemistry education and outreach. And she has the distinction of holding the world's first PhD in green chemistry from the University of Massachusetts. And she worked on environmentally benign synthesis of photoactive materials. And she can tell us what that is, because it's actually really fascinating and nowhere as scary as it sounds. She has an MS from the University of Massachusetts Boston and an undergraduate degree in chemistry. And she has worked as a professor of green chemistry and director of outreach and community education at the Center for Green Chemistry at the University of Massachusetts Lowell, and has background before that as an analytical chemist for the Gillette Company and as a scientist for Roman Haas Electronic Materials Division. And in 2004, she was awarded the Kenneth G. Hancock Memorial Award in Green Chemistry for her work on titanium dioxide semiconductors and their application in a special kind of solar cells. And she also serves on the editorial board of a new journal, which is actually really interesting if you're trying to follow this field. It's called Green Chemistry Letters and Reviews. And I will also say that if I had somebody like Amy teaching me chemistry in high school or college, I might have been a chemist. The next speaker will be Tracy Easthope, who is with the Ecology Center in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and she directs their chemical industry initiatives in healthy food and healthcare initiatives. And she also chairs a state-based group in Michigan that is working with Dow Chemical on accountability and is also on Michigan's Governor's State of Michigan Green Chemistry Roundtable. And she's a member of a whole host of task forces and initiatives that work on environmental health for children and also works with Healthcare Without Harm on these issues. And she has a master's degree in public health from the University of Michigan. And sitting to her right is Dr. Robert Israel, who has over nearly 25 years' experience in product safety and regulatory affairs and environmental sustainability. And he currently heads Johnson Diversey's Environmental Sustainability and Regulatory Affairs Program that works on sustainability for both customers and products. He previously held management positions in the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency in the Office of Pollution Prevention and Toxics, and subsequently served as a regulatory consultant to the chemical industry, and has lots of experience in various capacities advising business and government on environmental sustainability issues. And he has a PhD in organic chemistry from the University of Delaware. Lots and lots of credentials here. So green chemistry. I was really hoping that among our panelists would be Paul Anastas, who is sometimes referred to as one of the founders of green chemistry, and he really, really wanted to be here. He called up and apologized profusely, but he's been nominated for a post at the EPA to direct the Office of Research and Development there, and his confirmation process is not yet confirmed, and he really can't come out and talk to bunches of journalists while this is going on. But I thought one of the best ways to introduce people to the topic of green chemistry is to just share a couple of really brief things that Paul Anastas has both written and said that I think neatly sum up what green chemistry is all about. And the first is actually from the book Green Chemistry Theory and Practice that is written by Paul Anastas and John Warner, published in 2000. And in that they write, "In virtually every aspect in society, it has long been acknowledged that preventing a problem is superior to trying to solve it once it has been created." And that, as Amy will explain in much better detail, is really the absolutely fundamental principle of green chemistry. And the other thing I thought I'd share that Paul Anastas has said, both in conferences and when I spoke to him for an interview, is he said, we currently deal with chemical security through guns, guards, and gates rather than by redesigning materials. Protective measures against hazards can and will fail, and when they fail, risk goes to the maximum. So the whole idea behind green chemistry is designing materials that are benign at every aspect of their life stage. Benign by design is kind of a catchphrase for green chemistry, and that by not initiating pollution, not putting hazards into the environment, we are going to be protecting both human health and the environment. And with that, I will let Amy start.
Thank you. I'm actually going to stand up because I do have a PowerPoint presentation, so I'll be standing to flip through sides. So I apologize for this post in the middle. I hope to not alienate too many of you through that. Let me just turn this around as well. Okay, so I'm going to give you just a, I'm going to start off with just an overview of what green chemistry is. So hopefully we'll all be on the same page. Lizzie mentioned the Beyond Benign Foundation. This is a nonprofit arm of actually the Warner Babcock Institute here on the left. And this we formed both of these organizations about 2 years ago. We're just north of Boston, up in Wilmington, Massachusetts. And the Warner Babcock Institute for Green Chemistry was founded by John Warner, so that's the Warner side of things. And they actually work directly with companies to design greener alternatives. So if you're asking, you know, is this going to be successful, he's really making a great case for that. So, and like I said, we're the nonprofit arm. We do education, outreach, and training around green chemistry. So just to explain those two logos there on the bottom. And I'll mention those again a little bit later. But to start off, to give you an overview of what green chemistry is, just to make sure, and trying to figure out where exactly to stand here, I'll ask the question, why do we have pollution and environmental hazards in the first place? Is it because us chemists are innately evil and, you know, sitting around plotting the doom of the world? Well, as a chemist, I would say no. But I really have three answers that I want to go through with you, and then I'm sure there are many more that we could add to my answers. But if you think about scientists' roles traditionally throughout the environmental movement, and I'm sure you're much more familiar with this than I, but biologists, engineers, they've been doing outstanding and amazing things to really mitigate, clean up our our environment. You know, we don't have rivers catching on fire anymore. You know, the toxins that are out there are a little bit different these days, but they've done amazing things to actually clean up our environment. And chemists, you see up there on the right, we traditionally have had somewhat of a bad rap, but although I'd say it's deservedly so in many cases. But if you notice, really what's missing on that historically is synthetic chemists. The very folks that are working directly with chemicals on designing products, they've really been absent from the environmental movement. It's always been someone else's job to clean up or to worry about environmental hazards. So, you know, the very person making all of these wonderful advances that we've made throughout industrial chemistry has really been absent from the environmental movement. So what green chemistry does is it identifies that synthetic chemist, the person who has those materials right at the beginning stages. It identifies that chemist as the key practitioner in implementing pollution prevention technologies. So, of course, we're biased because we are chemists, as we say this, but we really think it's key in terms of preventing pollution. So this is really the definition, which is out of John and Paul's book. But you'll see some key words in here, the design. So it's an intentional design of chemical products and processes and how we manufacture, how we create these materials that reduce or eliminate the use or generation of hazardous substances. So that's the actual definition, which I'll bring up again in a little bit. But just if you think about this image up here, the very moment a chemist puts a pencil to paper, very moment a material scientist or an engineer at that very beginning stage, the moment they're thinking about what raw materials they're going to use, what are the sources they're using, what's the reagents, what are the catalysts, how are they, you know, all of these decisions at that very beginning design stage is what is going to impact further on down the line. So really, of course, like I said, I'm claiming my bias. I am a chemist, so I really think a chemist can have the greatest impact right at that very beginning design stage. And sorry, I'm going to be jumping back and forth because I have a lot of clicks through this slide. This is my PowerPoint extravaganza slide, so you have to pay careful attention. But so to help explain this, I'll say, okay, where do products come from? So where does my iPhone? I always use this as an example. Where does my iPhone come from? As chemists, we take atoms and we assemble them in ways to create various molecules. I'm supposed to ooh and ah at that point. Yeah, thank you. We then take these molecules and we assemble them in different arrays to make different materials. So it's a plastic, it's a micelle surfactant type material, it's a conductor, a semiconductor, all of these materials. And how we bring these molecules together defines these materials. We then combine materials to make different components and devices. So for example, I'll sit down for this one. So for example, if we have a component or device that when you trigger it, it actually will change property. Or if you have something else that when you shine light on it, it will actually cause a reaction to occur. Or another device that when you try to stick something to it, it might slide right off. That's my non-stick surface right there. So you can imagine how many of these little components and devices that have specific functionality go into something as amazing as my little iPhone. And it's anything from cosmetics to electronics. It's anything across the board. Of course, this is a very simplified version of where products come from, but it's really at that beginning stage where we're going to have the biggest impact. So think about it this way. I was a chemist for Rohm & Haas Electronic Materials. We were making optical electronic materials for the go inside of, say, touchscreen devices such as PDAs and touchscreen computers and those sort of things. We're making the polymer coating that goes on the outside. And when I got there, we would have group meetings where we would define what our design criteria was going to be for that product that we were trying to develop. And in our group meetings, we'd come up with, okay, it has to have a certain solubility, because we're actually going to coat it onto a surface. It has to have a certain melting point and glass transition temperature. If you have a PDA device and you leave it in your car and it's in the middle of the summer, it's hot, you don't want it to warp when you get it out of your car. It has to have a certain melting point or glass transition temperature. It has to have certain mechanical properties. So it's got to be a little bit tough, a little bit flexible on that screen. We don't want, when we press it to really crack and be brittle and break. But it has to have a little bit of flexibility to it as well. It has to have a certain refractive index. So this material, the way that it worked, it was a waveguide material, so it was carrying light and essentially making a grid of light on the surface. And so that when you touch your finger to where you're actually trying to, what you're trying to touch on that screen, it interrupts that grid of light, and that's how it triggers, that's how it knows where you're touching on the screen. So it had to have a certain refractive index of how, because it was actually bending light. It had to have a certain surface tension. So if we're making a coating on the surface, it couldn't beat up and essentially like drops of water on the surface. Anyway, we're getting into some fancy design criteria. But what didn't come up in these group meetings until I got there was, well, what about the toxicity? What about the environmental impact? Isn't that a design criteria? So it was never in our group meetings, like I said, until I got there, and it's never in the language of a chemist, of a material scientist, might be of an engineer. Engineers are a little bit, they're thinking more in terms of systems. But toxicity, environmental impact, if we're designing a product that fails in those two categories, shouldn't it be just the same as if it were to fail in those mechanical properties? Or if it were to warp in that hot car, shouldn't we see that as part of our design criteria? And if it does exhibit those properties, then it's simply a design flaw. So that's really what green chemistry is about, is including those two things. So this is my first answer. That was kind of a long-winded answer for the first one, and the second two are much quicker. But my first answer is, it's never really been in our language as chemists. It's not in our design criteria. We don't think of it as a property of material. We're not taught that. And it's always been someone else's job. There's the EH&S department. Let's have them worry about it. So my first answer. My second answer has to do with science education. And this is pretty important and another bias of mine since I'm running a company based on green chemistry science education. Non-science majors, at the undergraduate level, if you ever took a non-science majors course, you might remember that they're pretty jam-packed with environmental science. So we talk a lot about it, and we've got a lot of our textbooks they're jam-packed with this. You would think this is all we would think about in terms of as chemists. But the minute you actually become a chemistry major, there's no requirement in a bachelor's degree program, no requirement in a master's program, no requirement in a PhD program. Not one university, well actually there is one now, but not one university in the U.S. requires any knowledge or toxicity of environmental hazard for a chemist. The very people, the very professionals working with chemistry. It's kind of frightening, I think. Still today, about 50% of the U.S. universities require a language proficiency. So you have to be able to translate a research article from French to English and from German to English. Still today, in all of the technology resources that we have today, and yet we still think that we cannot fit this into our curriculum. So that's my second answer, is we're simply not taught how to create safe materials. It's not in our educational systems. My third answer, I'll go right out and tell you, chemistry is strange. You might agree with me on that one. But what do I mean by that? Think about everyday hazards. I do dangerous things all the time. I try to cook in the kitchen, and my husband knows it's very dangerous. And I've seen those infomercials with the guy with the big knives chopping the tomato, and I try to do the same thing, and inevitably I cut myself. And anyway, but I understand that I can cut myself with that knife. The function of that product, the knife, is to cut the food. The hazard associated with that function is that it can cut me. I understand it. There's a direct relationship with the function and the hazard. Same thing with the stove. I can burn the food. I can burn myself. But the function of that stove is to heat the food, cook the food. It's not really function to burn the food, but anyway. But in chemistry, we have all kinds of unrelated hazards. So if I were to want to design a red dye, I can pick up a textbook on how to design a red dye. I know, how many conjugated double bonds or triple bonds you needed across this array with an electron donating group on one side and an electron withdrawing group on the other side. And I know I can find out exactly how to make that dye. The function of the dye, that molecule, is to be red. The hazard, if I happen to develop one that causes cancer, that's more of an oops. The function is completely dissociated from the hazard. There's all kinds of examples, from that red dye to bisphenol A, which, it's an amazing polycarbonate plastic material that's used to make our eyeglasses, compact discs, or obviously water bottles, you know about that one. Lead, it was a whitening agent for white paint to keep it white. That function was completely dissociated from the hazard. Or phthalates, phthalate plasticizers, another completely dissociated from what the actual intended function is. So you think about that in terms of risk. Risk is a function of exposure times hazard. And what we do when we work with something that's quite risky or quite hazardous, we try to limit exposure, and we've done this throughout history of how we deal with chemicals. And all of those exposure hazards, all of those exposures is also a cost of doing business to a company. So if you're working with something that's very hazardous, you limit that exposure. Well, green chemistry is really focusing on that intrinsic hazard and designing out that hazard so that we don't really have to worry about the exposure part. Because exposure, and I think Lizzie already mentioned this, exposure controls can and will fail. We have plenty of instances where that has happened. So really quickly, how do companies and industries feel about green chemistry? Well, it is expensive to use and generate hazardous materials. It costs more to store it, to store hazardous materials, to transport, to treat them, dispose of them, regulatory costs, liability. The list goes on and on. New employee recruitment, more and more today. Young people really want to work for companies who are doing good. The Warner Babcock Institute put out a couple weeks ago an advertisement, and I think the next day they had at least 300 applications. So it's really, really changing. And it has to do, some of it has to do with this. This is a graph, this is John Warner's graph, of the number of laws over the past about 130 years or so. And you see that not too much happens till about 1962. Rachel Carson published Silent Spring. And then there's an explosion of environmental regulations. And if you take a closer look, there's all these 3, 4, 5-letter acronyms that tell you what you can't put out into the atmosphere, you can't put into the rivers. And all of this, I mean, it's wonderful, but it's also a cost of doing business to a company. So are they going to reach for a safer alternative if it exists? Absolutely. And a lot of it has to do with this. And it's also on a rise. I don't really see the trend going down here. It looks like it's pretty much going up. So important to note that green chemistry not only has to have an environmental benefit, but it also has to have the performance criteria in order to be adopted. So we're not going to buy a cleaner that doesn't clean just because it happens to have an environmental benefit. You don't want that one that leaves the streaks down your mirrors. You're also not really going to pay too much of a premium for a more benign alternative. Perhaps you might a little bit, but not too much. So it has to have the economics. So all three of these things, safety, performance, and cost, all of these three things combined is when you get green chemistry. I might just end about there. This is the book which Lizzie mentioned, Green Chemistry Theory and Practice. Really, this is where green chemistry was first defined, 1998, not too long ago. It's pretty brand new. And within this, it's the 12 principles of green chemistry are outlined. And this really speaks to a practicing chemist. So as a chemist, what would I do in a laboratory setting to actually go about designing greener alternatives? This formed, actually, Al Gore probably doesn't realize, but he really catalyzed the formation of green chemistry, or the Presidential Green Chemistry Challenge Awards, anyway. This green chemistry was formed from a union of John Warner and Paul Anastas. Paul was at the EPA at the time. I think you were responsible for hiring him, correct? Correct, Bob? Okay. And and John Warner was at Polaroid. So it was actually a collaboration between industry and government. It wasn't an academic idea somewhere. It was actual practical chemistry. And from that came the Presidential Green Chemistry Challenge Awards, which have been going on since 1996. And it's the only presidential award given out with chemistry in the name. But it's fantastic. It's great examples of chemistry that's out there today with some pretty big name companies up here. And they demonstrate those three criteria, the performance, economics, and the cost. I mean, the environment, economics, and the safety. I think I said that wrong. So I'm going to leave you on this thought. I don't want to leave you with just all this negative, why do we have environmental... Things are changing. So things are changing. We are learning how to incorporate toxicity, environmental hazard into our design. There's plenty of companies out there that are actually doing this at some level. We have institutes popping up that are solely dedicated towards green chemistry. We're teaching green chemistry at the K-12 level, colleges, universities. We're doing this across the U.S., India and China have amazing programs going on right now in green chemistry. India is making it mandatory that every chemistry undergraduate student must take a full year of green chemistry. China has, I think, about 16 research institutions dedicated solely to green chemistry. It's happening. Chemistry is still strange, but we're understanding the hazards better. And I'll just leave you, this is my last quote. Yes, it's hard and it's challenging, but it's a challenge that's really worth taking. So I really like this quote from JFK that really sums up the green chemistry movement. So with that, I will stop. Thank you so much for listening.
Hey. Thank you, Amy. And that's a great segue to Bob Israel from Johnson Diversey, who can tell us how his company is incorporating green chemistry. And I just was reminded with a note about Al Gore that for those of you who heard Vice President Gore this morning, he came very close to describing green chemistry when he told the anecdote about the company in Nashville called Northern Tel, when CFCs were being banned, and they looked and looked for other alternative substances they could use to clean the circuit boards, and then they realized, well, much better was to redesign the whole process, go back to the beginning, and look at the very beginning of the process. So with that, yeah. I'm going to go to Bob.
Thank you. Perfect segue. And I just want to say, Amy, thank you for saying that chemistry is strange and not chemists.
Okay.
Okay. I only wish that I had the opportunity to study green chemistry when I was going for my graduate degree. And as Amy very nicely summarized, it wasn't even on the horizon. Not that I'm that old, but it wasn't discussed at all. Fortunately for me, my first job was with the U.S. EPA. And so I got my training on the ground right away, and I've spent my whole career essentially in environmental protection in one form or another. One at the EPA, again, as a consultant to the chemical industry, and now with Johnson Diversey. How many people here know Johnson Diversey at all? Good. Couple. All right. Well, for the rest of you, just give you a little bit of background. Wait a minute. We're not at the right place here. There we go. Okay. Johnson Diversey is a sister company to the S.C. Johnson Company. Sam Johnson formerly had all the companies. We serve the industrial and institutional markets. So any kind of building that is not a resident is a building that we would provide products and services to. Okay, so hotels, schools, hospitals, food processing facilities, bottling, beverage companies, things of that sort. And our goal is to provide a range of products and services to help keep things clean and hygienic. So all the products that you know at S.C. Johnson, like Windex and Pledge and Glade and so on and so forth, we have our own versions of those whose names you probably have never heard of. But again, the sole purpose is to serve the institutional marketplace. That gives a very quick summary. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that, but gives a wide range of things that we cover. And it's not just chemicals, okay? And I'm going to make that part of what I'm going to talk about as well. Because for us, it has to go beyond just the chemistry that we use, because we use a lot of other things. We have a stated purpose in our company that basically is a living and breathing purpose that we do every day, and we take this to heart. We protect lives, we preserve the earth, and we transform our industry. That is our purpose as a company. The description is here. As a Sam Johnson company, this is a no-brainer for us. And those of you who know Sam Johnson, he was clearly a sustainability pioneer before it was even a word in our vocabulary back in the mid-70s. We protect lives by producing products that make food, drink, and facilities safer and more hygienic. We preserve the earth for future generations, and we will transform our industry essentially by trying to make our customers more sustainable themselves. This is how, within our company, just to put it into context, how we look at sustainability within our organization. It has to be embedded throughout every functional group, every area, every region, every geography, everything we do, from our president and CEO down to a guy on the line. Okay, and we do take this to heart. We have come up with 6 pillars of sustainability. Green chemistry would fit under our customer pillar because that's where we provide products to our customers, and we need to understand the impact that our products have on their operations and so on and so forth. However, there's obviously a lot more to our approach to sustainability than just the products that we produce. Oops, now I know why I'm skipping ahead. Okay, very quickly, there's a brief summary of our history at Johnson Diversey as it relates to some of our sustainability initiatives. Again, because of we're here to talk about green chemistry, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but just to help put our company in context. Well, we're part of the cleaning and hygiene industry, and so let me set the stage for that to be able to talk about green chemistry and how it plays in our industry by talking about what it is that we're after. First of all, through all of this, we cannot underestimate the importance of cleaning. Okay, just basic hygienic, you know, whether it's your home, whether it's the school where your children go, whether it's this hotel, or any indoor building, there is a definite purpose and importance to cleaning. We know that there are poor environmental quality areas that there have been studies to show that there's $60 billion of lost productivity in the U.S. alone every year just because of adverse health effects associated with poor indoor air quality or poor environmental quality. Asthma is the number one cause of absenteeism in schools. 14 million school days a year are lost due to asthma in children. So disease protection, food protection. Again, clean and hygienic is important to protecting the food at food processing establishments. The Cokes, the Pepsis, the big food processors around the world, their operations need to be kept clean and hygienic to try to prevent as much as possible, even though it happens all the time, the spread of disease through our food source. However, we also know that the cleaning industry is responsible for putting 5 billion pounds of chemicals in the environment every year in the U.S. alone. Okay, so when I look at that number, I say we have to do a better job as an industry, and we can. Okay, 5 billion pounds of chemicals. And when we clean, we all know this, when we clean, where do those chemicals go? They go down the drain. And it doesn't matter if it's in your home or in a commercial setting. So that sets the stage for now. How does Johnson Diversey make an approach to this? And again, Amy, you could have given some of what I need to talk about here. What Amy said earlier was, you know, there used to be nothing but an approach to saying it's cost and performance. How do we balance those out? We want the product to work. We want it to be a premium product in the industry that does the job. And we can't break the bank with it because no one will buy it. Okay. Well, our approach basically now says, well, we also have to incorporate green chemistry, sustainability metrics along with that equation. And we do that throughout every new product that we manufacture. Okay. So this is going to focus again more on our approach to green chemistry and how that is part of that whole thing and part of the whole decision-making process from product conception all the way through commercialization and introduction of that product in the marketplace. There's a number of steps that we have to think about. First of all, we have to note that we are a chemical formulator. We don't make chemicals. We're not Dow, DuPont, and so on. We're not BASF. Okay, we buy from them. We buy the finished chemicals that they make as those ingredients that have specific properties, whether they be soaps, surfactants, so on and so forth, solvents, that we use to make our products work. Okay, so, you know, we're somewhat of a large company. We're in 70 countries around the world. We've got over $3 billion in sales, and yet we're not necessarily in a position where we can dictate to our big suppliers what the types of chemicals that we need. They know we're interested, but we're still not big enough for them. That sometimes is frustrating for us. We can go to Dow and DuPont and say, here's a chemical we want to get rid of. We want to replace with something that is more, you know, friendly to the environment. We can't always get them to bite into that. Okay, we have to do that in a different way with much larger players or a group of players all going after the same thing. So how do we approach it in terms of our portfolio? Well, we do a number of things, and I've summarized it. I like to keep things really simple when I talk about these things. So it's basically taking out the bad. It's building in the good. And, again, it's more than just chemicals. And I'm going to talk through each one of these in a little bit more detail. Okay, taking out the bad. For us in our company, we have a number of chemical management policies. We require every product has to go through a regulatory and product safety review before it gets introduced in the marketplace. Hands down, there's no exception. Okay, marketers all the time want to say, well, why do we have to do this, and why do we have to get all this information? We say, look, it's the way we do business. We will do it. And then somebody new comes in and joins the company. Why? We get the same question over and over again. So that's a requirement under our corporate product responsibility policy. We have an animal testing policy that says we will not test on animals unless it's required by the government. And the government still requires us to do certain amount of testing in certain situations. For example, we sell sanitizers and disinfectants. And under the pesticide laws in the U.S., you're required to do some animal testing to support the claims that you have on that to show the product works. Moving on, though, we also manage what we call global action lists. And primarily it's two lists. It's a red list, which are a list of chemicals that are commonly used in our industry that are banned from use in Johnson Diversey. And we take actions to add things to that list. Okay, it's not a static list. We have a yellow list, which is a watch list. These are chemicals that we monitor in the industry for a number of reasons, whether it be because they're under increasing scrutiny, they're being regulated more, or there's some toxicological question that we're watching and monitoring on those chemicals, and so we're prepared to take action. We also move things from the yellow list to the red list, and in 2006, we banned alkyl phenol ethoxylates, nonyl phenol ethoxylate. Anybody, people familiar with that? Very common, very good working, cheap surfactant. However, it's known to be toxic to fish and also potential endocrine disruptor. Okay, well, so that's taking out the bad, just some examples of that. Now there's building in the good. We do seek out third-party certifications on some of our products. And we do this, one, because there's a customer demand for it. There are laws requiring it. And we also know it's the right thing to do. However, it can't be the only thing. Yes, we have products that are certified by all of these green certification organizations around the world. However, this next bullet is, to me, the most important one, and that is continuous improvement of the rest of our portfolio. Again, we're not always in control over the chemical choices that we have to make. And therefore, what we can do, though, is make sure that we're making the best possible choices, but always keeping an eye open to continuously improve our entire portfolio. We're now doing this with metrics. We want to be able to measure our improvement and not just say, well, we replaced one chemical with another in a couple of products. No, we want to be able to measure it for the raw materials, the formulas, and then the products, which includes the packaging types that we use as well, and be able to show how we're making progress. And this is for ourselves. This is not to publicize this anywhere except to say we know we're making improvements, we're hitting the targets that we set for ourselves. And then we have selective chemical replacement as well, and the example that I gave of the nonyl phenol ethoxylates is a good one on that. But we also work with our suppliers. We have to work with our suppliers. We also work with the NGO community, with US EPA. We have a large number of partners to be able to do that. So what are the characteristics for us? One of our goals is to have our entire portfolio meet all this criteria. We're not there today. We know we're not there today, and it's going to take some time to get there. Some of it is the state of the science, and some of it is the cost, the sheer cost of some of the replacements. There are some examples of replacements for certain chemicals that they don't fit the economic part of the model. Not yet. They will. And when they come down and come close enough, then we'll jump to some of those and hopefully have some more along the way. We want them to be non-regulated. There should be no hazardous ingredients. Everyone familiar with the global harmonization system, unifying how we report on hazards globally, basically through an MSDS. Okay, so there should be no hazardous icons that would show up on our MSDS. No CMRs and PBTs are carcinogens, mutagens, reproductive toxicants, and then PBTs, persistent, bioaccumulative, or toxic to the environment. We don't want any of our chemicals to meet any of our those criteria, be on any list of chemicals of concern. We are developing a list of chemicals that have a favored profile when it comes to human health and the environment. And then we want to look to biomimicry solutions that have low impact. So whether it be plant-based, enzyme, natural ingredients, you know, we're kind of questionable sometimes on what's called bio-based products, because at the end of the day, there are many bio-based products that are out there that merely are leveraging on the name bio-based. And I can show you a number of chemicals that are so-called bio-based that are just as toxic to human health and the environment. And so at the end of the day, it has to be about what is the impact of that chemical, petro-based, bio-based, naturally occurring, it doesn't matter. What's the impact on that chemical against those types of human health and environmental criteria? Okay, very quickly. I'm sorry. I'll go through this very quickly, I promise. But it's more than just chemicals. And for us, it has to be. Yes, we're a chemical company in a way. We formulate chemicals that are used for cleaning. However, we also want them, I'm going to jump right down to this last bullet. It's also about products that save water, conserve energy, and prevent waste. Again, everything we make goes down the drain, so how can we use less of it and make it just as effective? We still have to package it. We still have to ship it. All of those things are still there. All of those things have an impact on the overall sustainability of those products. Uh-oh. We don't want that. And I actually have... I have two examples. I'm only going to show one because of time. So here's an example of how we approach that then. This dispenser here, I call it the Miracle-Gro for the institutional cleaning market. You know what the Miracle-Gro dispensers look like? You put the powder in, you hook it up to your hose, and it dispenses the right amount of plant food to the plant. Same concept here for cleaning. Except the difference is that this is what we call a closed-loop system. You cannot get at that concentrate at all unless you physically damage the package. Why is that important? Because we take advantage of all of these sustainability savings on energy, greenhouse gas, reduced plastics, reduced waste, reduced shipping, reduced storage by concentrating the product and putting it in that type of package. But we know when we concentrate chemicals, what happens? They tend to get more caustic, corrosive, things of that sort. So by putting it in a dispenser where you can't get at the concentrate, because the only thing that comes out here is the end-use diluted chemical, okay, we feel that's a win-win. We still want to improve the chemical profile, but it's as good as we can get today. So that gives you an idea of some of the things that we're doing. I'm sorry I took more than my allotted time, but thank you very much.
And that, I think, is also a nice segue for Tracy, who is in Michigan, where jobs and economy are a huge and pressing issue, and she can talk a bit to how all of these new products and this transformation of industry is playing out in the state and policy arena.
Hi, thanks. I'm going to have someone advance my slides and see how that works. And just sit here. If we can pull up the... But I'll mention while the slides are coming up that I'm from the Ecology Center, which is a 40-year-old environmental organization in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And we work on a whole range of things. We do curriculum development. We work in schools on education. But we also are a business. We actually own a business which provides curbside recycling to the entire city and region and municipalities and businesses. So So we do a whole range of things. We work on sustainable food systems, land use, energy, but our major work is around toxic chemicals and manufacturing process and that connection to environmental health. So that's where a lot of our work is done. Next slide. And that was just about our organization. The next one. I think we're most well-known nationally recently for our consumer product databases, and you may have heard of Healthy Car and Healthy Toys, where we actually use an XRF screening methodology to test consumer products. Next slide. And we just launched HealthyStuff.org, which is a combination of all of our consumer product testing databases, and it expands to pets and women's purses and a whole series of other things. Next slide. As Lizzie mentioned, you know, I'm in Michigan. We have the nation's worst economy, and we have had for a long time. Our budget deficit is calculated variously, but probably $2.8 billion now and another $3 billion next year. And our unemployment is at 15.2%, and our tax revenues are down by 22%. So it's quite a grim situation. We have a significant manufacturing base still. I mean, we make a lot of stuff. We have a large plastic sector, significant agricultural sector, big tourism sector. We are the largest surface freshwater system on Earth. And polling data suggests that citizens in Michigan are extremely connected to the lakes and very strongly understand persistent bioaccumulative toxic chemicals and other toxic chemical issues and understand the connection to their health. So we have this interesting situation where a lot of jobs are associated with manufacturing, but a deep connection to the land and the resource. Next slide. In 2006, we finally won the signing of the first executive directive on green chemistry in the country by the governor in 2006. Next slide. Which essentially does a bunch of things, and it was and I don't know if you noticed, but it said for sustainable, for economic development and protection of public health. And that was the key focus of the Green Chemistry Executive Directive. But it sets out two things. First is to support a roundtable of stakeholders within the state to come together to figure out how do we advance green chemistry in Michigan. And the second is to create a support program. This is voluntary, non-regulatory, and this was something we decided to pursue in addition to our other regulatory initiatives, which our organization also does, and I will talk about very briefly at the end. This was purposefully non-regulatory to get as many of our huge stakeholders at the table as possible to try and make the most change more quickly in our situation as possible. Next slide. This is a list of the people who are on the roundtable. You can see General Motors, Dow, Herman Miller. Next slide. Significant a representation from some of the key departments within the state. Next slide. And then a significant number of working chemists from major research institutions. And then next slide, a few of us NGOs. Next slide. And just go through these two quickly. Sorry, this is to move quickly. This is just us in action, the Green Chemistry Roundtable, and that's when we had special guests Amy Cannon and John Warner. So it wasn't until 2008 that the state actually found money to do something with this executive directive, and which is astonishing because we're about to, you know, cut off children and, you know, any kind of health care for children, et cetera, et cetera. But this was from a bond, a separate pot of money. And one of the things we did was contract with the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production, which is a leader in the country in green chemistry and chemicals policy work, to interview stakeholders and do a plan for us. And it's in three phases, building awareness, building the program, building the future, over a five-year time frame. Next slide. One of the things about building, one of the goals under the building awareness was to create a Michigan gubernatorial green chemistry award based on the presidential green chemistry award. So we just did that. Next slide. And this is, we expanded it beyond the presidential green chemistry awards to include a public component, which would community activities to advance green chemistry would be acknowledged. We expanded it to acknowledge student at all levels of students, graduate, undergraduate, and high school students to be acknowledged, and then expanded the academic and education categories. So there's quite a few more categories, and the idea was, how do we create momentum? How do we create a buzz around this and make things happen in the state? So next slide. This is a picture of our first Green Chemistry Awards ceremony in one of the crown jewels of Michigan, which is the Diego Rivera murals at the Detroit Institute of Arts, which is an incredible mural, if you haven't seen it, about the auto industry, but also about the history of technological advancement and the relationship to humans and both the promise and peril of technology. It's this entire room filled with these murals. So it was quite apt to have our first award ceremony there. Next slide. I'm just going to mention a couple of the companies that received awards. One of them is PPG Industries, which has a new, a chemical which is a paint denaturant. It's used in painting automobiles, and there's a lot of auto assembly plants in Michigan. There's still a lot of assembly that goes on there. And this is, there was a chemical with formaldehyde and melamine, which was quite toxic, that was used. And this chemical that they developed is made based using shrimp shells, lobster shells, and crab shells. And so it has reduced significantly the emissions from auto assembly plants, which is terrific. Next one. This is a process which has only been piloted, but there's about 300 small plating, metal plating plants in the state, and this would reduce dramatically the emissions from those facilities. And again, it's in pilot phase. Go ahead. This is still in development, but it is water used as a solvent to replace a pretty nasty solvent that's used in chemical production. Next slide. And then I think this is the last one I'll mention, which is Grand Valley State, which is on the west side of the state, has really been a leader in green chemistry education. And they have now developed a green chemistry certification. So they don't have a full program yet, but they're on their way to creating a full program. So they also won an award. Next slide. I just go through those to give you a sense of what we're trying to highlight and how we're trying to do it. The other thing that happened the day after that was a big conference, our first conference, which was oversold was in Detroit. Basically had a bunch of sessions on different aspects of green chemistry and green chemistry education and green engineering. And of the 150 participants, the vast majority were people from business, interested in what was happening in different, and there were some academic presentations about what's happening in academia as well. So, it was, I think, a very important launch for our program in Michigan. Next slide. We also have launched a Green Chemistry Education Network, and the first meeting of that was in May, and there were chemistry teachers at the at the university level and the high school level as well. And they just launched a Green Chemistry Education newsletter as well, to report on green chemistry curriculum, also education activities that are going on in the state. Next slide. And you're starting to see this happen within institutions. This is the student members of the American Chemical Society at the University of Michigan who have their own green chemistry page. So you're starting to see green chemistry pop up within academic institutions in the state. Next slide. This is just a little portion of the curriculum at Skyline High School, which is in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And Skyline is the first high school in the country to require a green chemistry semester for all students. Next slide. We also have been looking at how we can change great green chemistry, how we can look at the only place there's money in the state at all is in economic development, and even that's drying up. How can we green our state's economic development strategy, and how can we green those dollars? And one of the ways to do that is looking at these three bills, which are bills to expand Michigan's economic development statutes to include green chemistry. And those have passed the Michigan House, but await action in the Senate. Next slide. The roundtable funded several activities which have helped to seed green chemistry action in the state. I just want to mention a couple. One on this slide, which is four research institutions were given money to pilot green chemistry curriculum and then report at that seminar that I mentioned on how those went. And they also did some polling of some research on how students perceive the classes, how they like them, you know, whether they return, et cetera. So I think that was an important activity and has started to launch more green chemistry curriculum development in the state. Next slide. And then another funding project of the roundtable has been to give the Society for Automotive Engineers some money to develop a workshop to basically look at the feasibility of a technology transfer center in the state so that for the auto sector to get good ideas within academia to be transferred to the shop floor within the auto sector. Next slide. I just want to mention that we're working on a bill to phase out DECA. We're working on a bill to phase out Lindane. More than half of the incoming state legislators signed our pledge to this, our healthy products legislation. Next slide, which includes these planks: eliminate added toxic chemicals. This is just in children's products. Identifying priority chemicals of concern. Next slide, inform consumers. Participate in interstate planning and then a green economy plank. That legislation has also passed the House and awaits action in the Senate and probably will wait longer. that's not likely to go through soon. Next slide. And then the final slide.
Okay.
Which is, where do we go next? I think these are some of the key sort of opportunities and challenges for us. First is to figure out how to do technology transfer and how the state can facilitate technology transfer through the development of centers or in whatever way we can do that. There are a number of models out there that are trying to do that. To build a resource clearinghouse so people know what's happening within the state and connections can be made. Continuing to advance green chemistry education at all levels of science education. Funding is always a key question for all of these, the above. And then greening economic development, because that's where a lot of money is going in the state around new business development. I think that we also have a challenge that our green chemistry addresses some of our most serious challenges in the state. So thank you very much.
And thank everybody for letting me be a draconian moderator. It's so hard to ask people to speak for such a short time on such a big subject, but I want to make sure we have enough time for questions before the next session, which actually starts at 3:45, but there's a beverage break at 3:30, and Tracy has a plane to catch, so I'm going to ask people who have questions for her maybe get those up first. But one question that I wanted to ask the panelists while you're thinking of your questions is to, I know we promised we'd address nanotechnology, but you sort of have to lay down all of this framework first. And as the way I see it, nanotechnology fits in because that's where so many of the new materials are being made. And I was wondering if Amy and Bob might be able to just say very briefly how nanotechnology fits into the green chemistry agenda and thinking about the materials you're putting out in the marketplace. And then for everybody, how do you go about communicating to your various constituencies what's actually green? And I know Bob addressed that to some extent, but that comes up again and again in all of these arenas, whether you're launching an educational or business development strategy or a new process or product. So maybe start with the the what's green thing and.
For us in our industry, I think that you know there's a lot of activity in trying to define green. There are a lot of organizations trying to position themselves as the organization to define green. The problem is that many times people just define it in on a hazard-based set of criteria, without considering what I think is important, which are still the sustainability attributes as well. So even if we have, by any definition, the greenest chemical out there, does that mean that we still shouldn't take advantage of what we can do to reduce packaging, reduce energy, and reduce waste around how we deliver those products as well? So to me, that has to be incorporated into the definition of green, because otherwise it's just like you have the three-legged stool of sustainability. You're only addressing a portion of the equation. You're not addressing the whole thing.
I would agree with that, and just add to the defining green is a big thing that a lot of people are trying to do right now, and it's kind of a heated discussion around you know, how to actually measure the greenness, especially in terms of green chemistry, because it's very principle-based and chemistry-based, research-based science. But what one of the things in green chemistry that we like to focus on is that it's always greener chemistry. It's I go back to this analogy that John Werner used once, which I think just works so well, that, you know, the runner is always aiming towards a zero-minute mile. You know, are they ever going to get there? No. But, you know, that's our goal, is zero waste, zero hazard, energy efficiency, all of these things. That's our goal. We're constantly trying to get, you know, make incremental steps towards that goal. So it's always, we always use greener chemistry.
I just want to support that as an environmentalist. This issue comes up all the time, and we're skeptical of greenwash, and actually businesses are becoming skeptical of other businesses around greenwashing as well, so it's become kind of a problem, and NSF is now trying to develop standards around greener chemical processes, which has become quite contentious. I think key things are we do need to look at hazard, not risk, but we do need to look at the entire life cycle of products and chemicals. And we need to be really transparent, and that's sort of what we've done as an organization, is be very transparent about what you're saying about a particular and what against what you are measuring it. And as long as you're being extremely transparent, this is what it does, this is what it doesn't do, I think that at least gets us a little bit further along in educating the public and providing, you know, good information about what standards can and can't do, or, you know, whatever.
And I guess why don't we move to some questions from the audience, and just I've been reminded to remind people of the SEJ ground rules, which is SEJ members get to go first and tell us who you are when you ask a question. So, yeah.
Well, it's not. The question was about here in the U.S. Is there, you know, well, how I mentioned that there really is only one university that actually has a requirement for green chemistry, understanding toxicity, environmental hazard. Yet overseas in India and China, India is implementing currently now that. Chemistry undergraduate students take a full year of green chemistry, and in China there is, I think it's up to 16 research institutions. I can point you to an actual study about that too, though, if you're looking for it. So what's the problem here in the U.S.?
Can we start the whole time?
We did. It did pretty much start here, although there was a lot of key folks over in the UK as well who were key contributors in the early days. But not to get it wrong, here in the U.S., we have some of the most cutting-edge research coming out of our research institutions and our companies here in the U.S. So when you're looking at academia versus industry, industry's far beyond academia, and that's academia is quite conservative and moves generally a little bit slower. Although in academia there are several research institutions and academic institutions, four-year colleges, that are implementing it into their curriculum. They're not necessarily making it a requirement of their students, but they're putting it in there. So there are a lot of places. University of Oregon is doing this. They have fantastic example there, Carnegie Mellon. Up in the New England area, we have a whole network of green chemistry educators, mostly at the four-year college undergraduate level, that are building this into their curriculum. It's so hard to make it a requirement. One of the things, the American Chemical Society, the biggest professional society for chemists, they actually certify chemistry programs, and in their certification they list all of these requirements, and right now they do not list any we've been pushing them to list environment, toxicity, green chemistry, but they have not budged on that yet, and it's another thing that just really, if they were to do it, so many places would then switch and follow suit. But it is sort of this grassroots thing that's happening all over the place, happening at universities in Michigan, all over the place. So just to not get it wrong, it is happening here, but it's also interesting. John always points out that the places where we're exporting our manufacturing is where they're actually, they kind of get it, because they can see more directly the impact of their pollution.
The question was, again, about transparency and how do we let consumers know what's actually green rather than just sticking a leaf and a green label on something that could be utterly toxic.
Let me just answer that first, but I'm very interested in the other panelists. Our organization is shocked by the lack of information and disclosure, and so we actually test products. And that's the only way to find out what's in a toy. And not only that, but a lot of the distributors don't know because supply chains are so complex. The dirty little secret is we don't really know what's in things. And once you know what's in them, a lot of chemicals haven't been fully tested, which is why the big, enormous debate, which Lisa Jackson, the EPA administrator, has now put her shoulder to the stone on, is reforming our nation's chemical law, TSCA, Toxic Substances Control Act, which is 30 years old, never been updated, doesn't require basic toxicity testing for all chemicals, et cetera, doesn't give EPA the tools to take dangerous chemicals off the market. But I think that's why our organization has stepped in and done what little we can, a tiny little slice of actually testing consumer products. I think that cleaning chemical companies have been in the forefront of actually a few of the most progressive have actually started to disclose all of the ingredients. So they're really in the forefront in terms of products that are chemical formulations. But I'm curious to hear about the like, what are you doing?
Well, in our industry, we already disclose quite a bit. Do we disclose everything? I won't say that we do. We come pretty close, and and always have, even before what some of the S.C. Johnsons and Cloroxes and P&G are starting to do now, a lot of that is driven by, to some extent, what's been required of us to put on our MSDS anyway, or on state and community right-to-know laws around. We do it anyway. I think the real crux of the matter, as you alluded to, is what we really need to communicate are the hazards associated with the products. First of all, I believe in transparency. Let me say that, and I'm going to say it again. I do believe in transparency. The problem is that, on the one hand, confidentiality has been overabused. Not overused, but overabused in the chemical industry. And yet there is a right place for it. So if a company is to invent something new, how do they protect that and still be transparent? And that's where the way things are today, I still have a little bit of struggle. When I think about full disclosure on everything that we do across our entire portfolio, I'm mostly okay with the exception of a couple of key technologies that we have that nobody else has in our industry. So how do I protect that? The way we protect it, I think, is through TSCA, or TSCA reform, in that we have better data on the impact of these chemicals on human health and the environment. If we had that, if we had it as a requirement, because TSCA doesn't require it today, REACH in the European Union will require it. So do we take that and bring that over here? That's part of the big debate. But at the end of the day, if we had more information on the impacts of the chemicals, that's really the information that needs to be communicated, is when I use this chemical, what are those hazards? So I see that as the sort of the balancing act we have.
And sadly, maybe time for one or two more quick questions. It's Sharon? Only sadly, I think we have about 2 minutes, and then we're going to have to wrap up. But
our banned list, and I'm trying to recall the exact number, but it's probably between 20 and 30 that are on our list. It is a global list, so it takes into account every place that we operate around. What you're referring to into the 80,000 chemicals that have very little test data on is, in fact, the Toxic Substances Control Act. TSCA never required companies to produce unless there was cause. That was the fundamental problem with the program. That's what the challenge is that has to be addressed, along with the cost of gathering all that data, testing for all that data. Again, the confidentiality, I think I said my piece on that. It is a double-edged sword. So something has to change. I think TSCA fundamentally has to shift the burden to the chemical manufacturer and the downstream user than from EPA. That's where it hasn't worked.
And if I can just add that, you know, we're told that an amendment or a bill to reform TSCA is imminent to be introduced. And we'll see what's in it, but more importantly, what happens after it's introduced and who lines up where. And I think it'll be interesting to watch where the downstream users go in this debate. That's critical because that's most of the industries. That's not the manufacturers of chemicals. Those are all the industries that use. How are the downstream users going to place themselves in this debate?
And I think other critical things to watch are what's the burden of proof, how much testing is going to be required, what's the suite of chemicals that are going to actually be tested, is it going to be all, is it going to be prioritized, whatever. There's a few really key things, I think, to watch in the debate. And then how much does the government, through its actions, reward, change the playing field, reward those who do good, and penalize those who don't. You know, in other words, make it easy to do the right thing and hard to do the wrong thing. How much does the legislation do that? We'll see.
And just what? Oh, absolutely. I was just going to add to the numbers. You said you had 30 chemicals on your red list? About
20 and 30.
Sony, they have something they call a green book of chemicals they're monitoring, and this may include a whole sweep of things that are absolutely off limits, things they would consider 18,000 on their watch list of chemicals.
That's different than the red list.
Yeah.
But they have a few more chemicals than we do.
Yeah.
But the one thing I wanted to add, though, with TSCA reform is an opportunity. Okay, here isn't for you know if you even if you put aside the test and the costs and all those burdens and trying to get all the right data, what we have in TSCA reform is an opportunity to embed green chemistry. And we've spoken about that several times. You know, under TSCA right now, there's a number of exemptions to sort of shorten the review time that EPA has to review a chemical prior to introducing it into the marketplace. There is no green chemistry exemption. So why not have something like that to help bring on innovation in green chemistry and bring those things to the marketplace quicker?
Okay, one very quick last question. That's a great question.
There's a number of ways to try to address
sorry,
that.
Oh, sorry, I'm supposed to repeat the question. Oh. My apologies for the recorder. If a company like Johnson Diversey is not large enough to be able to dictate to the suppliers, the big Dows and DuPonts, what's going to make that happen and how do you do that?
Yeah. There's a number of ways to do that. A consortium approach is one way, but partnering with a whole lot of stakeholders is yet another. The problem in partnering as a consortium is that now I'm taking all my competitors and now we're all asking for the same thing. You know, and then there's always that, you know, the competition and innovation versus trying to move to greener alternatives. So, I mean, that's always a question. And someone in my position says, hey, I just want to get it done. Let's do it. But the marketers and the sales and everyone else, that, you know, they're looking at it from a competitive advantage. And rightfully so. I mean, we're still a business. So it's, you know, but there are other ways to get at it through partnering, through things like Design for the Environment and the work that they've done to try to get chemical manufacturers who manufacture new green chemicals to submit them to this database. And there's one for our industry. It's called Clean Ingredients. And a lot of work has gone on that for the last several years to try to get greener alternatives into an available database that anyone in the cleaning industry can now pick from and know that they have one of the greener alternatives available. So that there's lots of ways to do that.
Yeah, and just a few things that are happening out there now. There's what's called the GC3, Green Chemistry and Commerce Council. It's also started. Are you on that? Okay, good. And that started out at UMass Lowell, the same group that did the report for Michigan. But it's really doing exactly what you're talking about, trying to through the users push through the supply chain green chemistry and demanding. So there's some big names that are involved there too. There's Walmart's and Staples. You know, some really big names that could really change that supply chain. The other thing that's happening within the American Chemical Society Green Chemistry Institute, they have a couple roundtables, which is more of these consortiums that they can, you know, rally around some common problems and really help find solutions. So there's a pharmaceutical roundtable of pharmaceutical companies, and what they've done is identified the top, I think they've come up with 25 or so concerns of actual chemical reactions that affect the pharmaceutical industry. And they offer grants to research institutions, you know, to actually find alternatives for them. So it's a way, and then they've got some sort of sharing of the you know, IP and information that they've worked out within that consortium. And there's also a formulators roundtable that was just started for formulators. I don't know if you're part of that, too. You are? All right, good. So there's some of these roundtable-type consortiums that are happening.
And then the one other one I wanted to mention, just a sweep in the nanotechnology, and there's something called ICON that's based at Rice, which is an initiative where people who are testing the toxicity and environmental impacts of these brand new materials that are at a scale that behave like nothing else, they're actually sharing this toxicology information, which is completely novel. Nobody's ever shared information at that stage like that. So there's a lot, none of this is a magic solution, but it's really brand new for chemistry and chemical industries. So.
And we could stay here all day and talk about this. I know everybody's really enthusiastic, so thank you all for being here, and I'm sure folks will stay just a couple seconds to exchange business cards or give contact information. So thank you very much. Thanks.